Hey everyone, Jared Sebesta here, host of Repurposed. Here's your podcast. I hope you enjoy.
I started discipling guys in prayer. I took 61 guys one by one, one-on-one discipleship through Operation Timothy in prison, introduced them to Jesus. Most productive years of my life at $20 a month for 8 years after $3 million a year for 8 years. And it was the most productive years of my life were in prison.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Repurposed, a show dedicated to inspire you to live a life of purpose, intentionality, and of impact. I'm your host, Jared Sebesta of Teaches Financial Group, a retirement planning firm based in West Central Minnesota, where we teach true wealth. If you want to find out more information on us, just go to our website, teachesfinancial.com. Well, on this episode of Repurposed, I am so excited to be bringing you a conversation I had with Mark Whitaker. How many of you have ever seen or heard of the movie The Informant with Matt Damon? It came out about 8-10 years ago. That movie was based off of the life of Mark Whitaker, who was the president of the bioproducts division of Archer Daniel Midland, or ADM, back in the early 1990s. Well, Mark exposed an international price-fixing conspiracy for the FBI shortly after starting at ADM. He wore a wire for almost 3 years for the FBI, helping to establish one of the largest price-fixing cases in U.S. history. Now, Mark ended up going to federal prison for over 9 years, but the best part of Mark's story is that in federal prison, he found his purpose, his true purpose and meaning in life. Here's my chat with Mark Whitaker. Well, you have got just an incredible story. I just want to get right to it. The first question I have for you is how you became an informant with the FBI. And let's start when you're in your lower 30s. You just got a job with a company called ADM. Take us back to that point in time in your life.
Yeah, I was 32 years old at that time, and it was 1989, so we're talking 29 years ago. And I was divisional president of ADM's biotech division. That was the fastest-growing division of the company. The company was split into four divisions. And by the way, ADM, a very large company. It was the 56th largest company in America at that time, the 56th largest company on the Fortune 500. Today, they're the 41st largest company on the Fortune 500. So this is a huge Fortune 50, not just Fortune 500, but Fortune 50 company.
Yeah.
And I was divisional president of the biotech division. Our CEO was 75 years old. Our president was 69. And I was 32, and boy, did I think I was a rock star at that time.
You said that in like your first week, you got introduced to the corporate jet. Talk about that.
Yeah, the seven top executives each got their own jet. We had seven jets. So I was executive number four. I was the fourth ranked executive out of the 30,000 employees. So I did have a corporate jet assigned to me my first week at ADM. And in the first month, I bought the CEO's home. He lived in it for about 30 years, wanted to move to something smaller with being 75 years old. And I bought his former home my first month there, and a mansion with an 8-car garage and horse riding stables. And I mean, this is the kind of house that that a Bill Gates would live in.
Sure. And you're 32 years old, and you said that it had an 8-car garage. So what was one of the first things you did with your new salary and new bonus?
Well, I tell you, with my salary and bonuses, it was in the seven figures for the 7 years that I worked there, starting year one. And so within my first few months, I had that 8-car garage filled. I had a Ferrari, two BMWs, two Mercedes's. I was saying, look out, Justin Bieber, here I come. This was a Bon Jovi lifestyle at that time.
That's crazy. Just a quick insight as to what ADM does. Just give a quick, again, synopsis of what exactly they do.
ADM is one of the largest food additive companies in the world. It would be difficult for any of your listeners to buy processed food at the grocery store. And by that, I mean a Campbell's soup, a Kellogg's cereal, an orange juice, an iced tea, a Coca-Cola, a Pepsi, about anything that a food and beverage that's not a raw vegetable or a raw fruit would have ingredients from ADM in it. Again, one of the largest food additive companies in the world that touch every consumer that goes through the grocery store.
Sure. That's crazy. Getting to the point where you actually started working for the FBI and blowing the whistle on your own company, you give a lot of credit to actually your wife being an integral part of this whole process.
Yeah, my wife, Ginger, was really key to that, and I've been married to Ginger for 39 years now. Boy, for her to go through what she goes through is a miracle of God that she stayed with me
right
during that time. But I told her what was going on, where with the CEO being heading close, you know, heading towards his 80s at that point, because I was 3 years at the company at that point. So it'd be 1992 when I was 35 years old, and Ginger's a year younger than me. We met when she was in seventh grade and I was in eighth grade, and we went to our high school proms together, and we were the homecoming king and queen and so on. So we were very, you know, engaged in our school and just very active in our school and good students. And so I've known her since she was 13 and I was 14. And I told her about how the company was mentoring me and showing me how to do price fixing, where they were involved with the international cartel of some of the ingredients that go into the foods of your listeners. Right. And they were involved with it for 12 years. And I was there 3 years at that time. They got to know me. They got to trust me. Obviously, they needed to kind of train others as they were getting up in age, had to train kind of another generation to be able to take their place to manage this cartel, to run this cartel. And so for about 7 months, they were engaged in training me how to be part of this cartel and how to be involved with price fixing. And I had to share that with Ginger, and she basically forced me to turn myself in that very day, wow. Turn myself into the FBI when I shared it with her.
Did you know exactly the levity of what was happening at work every day?
I did. You know, when they brought me into it 7 months earlier before I shared it with Ginger in 1992, they were telling me, they said, look, Mark, these price-fixing laws called antitrust laws are on the books since the 1800s, and these politicians don't know anything about business. Anybody who knows anything in business would have never made these laws and put these laws in place. You know, this is what I was told. They said, we're a commodity company. We have to do this. The only way we survive is by doing this. So, again, it's just politicians that put these laws on the books that have no idea how to run and manage a business. So they rationalized when they told me, and that really encouraged me to rationalize. And I loved that job so much, and I loved the compensation that I had from that job, that I went along with it. But when I shared it with Ginger, she saw, wow, this is just outright theft. And I told her it was illegal, but everybody does it. She said, wow, if it's illegal, we've got to expose it. And like I said, after a couple-hour discussion, she forced me that very day on November 5th, 1992, to share it with the FBI.
Okay,
and that's how I became an informant.
So she gave you an ultimatum, basically saying, I'm going to turn you in, or you turn yourself into the FBI. And so you chose actually calling the FBI yourself.
Well, yes. FBI actually did a lot of things for ADM. I mean, Decatur, Illinois is about 30,000 employees and an 80,000 people town. Yeah. So the Decatur FBI office, I mean, they were helping even when I joined in 1989 with the Chicago Border Trade fraud case. So the FBI was already pretty engaged in helping ADM.
Right.
But this was the first time they were involved with something actually investigating ADM.
So how did that what's that conversation sound like?
Oh, I tell you, when you tell somebody, the authorities, that you're stealing $1 billion a year, not a million, but a billion, and been going on for 12 years, I can tell you, that phone, it reached Janet Reno, the director of the FBI, the attorney general. This became the largest price-fixing case in history. And if your listeners go to the Washington, D.C. FBI Museum, the equipment I wore undercover as an informant is in that museum. That's how big this case was.
Yeah, that's crazy. So you kind of thought like your job was done at that point. Once you got off the phone, you're like, thank you very much, I'm going to go back to my life. But it wasn't that way.
No, it was actually an in-person meeting, and I really had, after 4 hours of confession to the FBI what was going on. My wife had a good argument. She was with me during that time that, you know, I'm involved with something 7 months. It's been going on for 12 years. I'm not even managing it yet. I'm just kind of learning about it. I'm being mentored how to do the price fixing.
Right.
So, you know, as she said, it was really a good time to discuss it because it only involves 7 months. But boy, from the FBI standpoint, I was the only one confessed to that point. So I had no choice. I had to either be an informant or would be arrested. There was no choice there.
Right. So you chose to be an informant. And so how did it start? What did they tell you? What did you start to have to do?
Well, the next morning I met several FBI. There were four involved with this case. I met the FBI the following morning. They shaved my chest, wired, put microphones on my chest, and had a tape recorder in a briefcase, one in a notebook, one attached to my body with an athletic band on my back. And I met those FBI agents every morning where I was wired up for 3 years. Every Monday through Friday, wired up 8, 9, 10 hours a day for 3 years.
What did they want you to do? Did they give you instructions on how to orient conversations, or what
How did it was that so easy. Go? It was so easy to do because ADM was so entrenched in price fixing. Okay. All they wanted me to do is just be in the room and capture what was being captured. I mean, it was so much said about how much money was made. I mean, every day something was captured about the actual illegal activity. And then I actually sat in the cartel meetings too because I was being trained. So even with all the competitors, you know, we would have sometimes seven guys in a room, sometimes up to 11 with our competitors. And I taped all those meetings too. Those were the main meetings that were really used with the jury when the actual price fixing was taking place with the competitors.
Right. Talk about the competitors because it's like several major corporations and companies involved at this time, right?
Oh, yeah. Large corporations. A lot of them international, like Ajinomoto in Japan, Kiwahako in Japan. A lot of international food additive and feed additive companies. And they were very large, multi-billion dollar companies like ADM. ADM was about $70 billion in revenue. I think they're about $85 billion in revenue now. But they were other large companies like that, and a lot of them international. And it was, I mean, it was just blatant, splitting up the market. Hey, you take Hershey's, we take Nestle's, you take Kellogg's, and just split up the market and just drove those prices up as high as they could be as high as they could be driven.
Right. Again, did you understand the levity at the time? Because you're in the meeting with these major players of major companies talking about billions of dollars. If they found out that you were wiretapped, I mean, they could kill you. I mean, is that right?
Oh, yeah. The FBI told me when they wired me up. Matter of fact, there's a documentary on my website, markwhitaker.com, by Discovery Channel. And the FBI agents are actually all retired now. They're actually being interviewed on that documentary along with Ginger and I. And I mean, they talk about it on that documentary and they talked about it when they wired me up. They said, Mark, if these guys catch you, they're going to kill you. Yeah, this was pretty serious stuff. This is billions of dollars involved in people's lives of going to prison.
But you're not an FBI agent. You're just a guy just trying to manage his division.
I was just a divisional president, a very fast growing division, about $1.5 billion revenue. I mean, a wonderful division,
right?
Fast growth. And at the same time, I'm wearing a wire in everything I do.
That's great. Talk about the green lamp. I've heard you mention that in some of your talks. That is so funny. Talk about the green lamp.
Yeah, there was, the FBI knew they were going up against one of the largest companies in the world with ADM. And so they knew this would be they would have, you know, tremendous resources at trial. This was a 7-week trial. And ADM, tremendous resources with being a $70 billion company. And so the FBI wanted to be able to show a jury, not just a jury to hear the tapes from the audio tapes that I was making, but actually show the crime taking place
right.
in these international cartel meetings. So the video camera was in this green lamp that looks like it came from a yard sale. And it's amazing. This green lamp would be with the same, no matter if it was 5 or 6 guys or up to the 11 guys, it'd be with the same guys every time we met, and not one person noticed. I mean, sometimes it'd be 2 or 3 times a month in the room with us, and not one person noticed, and it was sitting 5 feet from them, no matter what hotel or no matter what country we were in.
Yeah, and it's not a real high-end looking lamp, and you're in high-end hotels.
Yeah, I'm talking like Shangri-La in Singapore, $1,000 a night hotel, and here's this green lamp in this conference room that looks like it came from a yard sale, as I mentioned. And I just thank God that there wasn't a woman among us. There wasn't a woman criminal among us because
she would have pointed it out right away.
Yeah, she would have said that green lamp was following us around the world.
But as you were doing this, the pressure was on. There was the greed was through the roof with your company, even probably with yourself in a lot of way. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I loved, you know, having a corporate jet and living in a mansion. You can imagine at 32 years old living like that. You know, it's almost 3 decades ago. I loved that life. I was obsessed with that lifestyle. I couldn't imagine life without it. I mean, I felt like Bon Jovi, as I mentioned earlier.
Right.
And I just couldn't imagine life without earning 7 figures a year for, like I said, the 7 years that I was there. But the amazing thing is that I did realize, and Ginger really had me convinced that, you know, I was going to be fired when they learned I was an informant. And they did fire me that very day that they learned. And so what I did is, I thought, well, who's going to hire somebody that's being an informant wearing a wire against their own company? I'm only mid-30s by that point.
Right.
I got my PhD from Cornell University in biochemistry only a decade earlier at age 25. So I'm really just the beginning of my career And I thought, well, who's going to hire somebody in their mid-30s that's wore a wire and been a whistleblower against their own company? No one. Right. It's actually easier to get a job as a felon than a whistleblower in corporate America.
Interesting.
Absolutely. I see a lot of felons get great jobs, but whistleblowers never get jobs. I mean, they're unemployed, a lot of them for life. And so so basically what I did, I started, and again, by this time, I'm really cracking under the pressure. I'm wearing a wire 8-9 hours a day. I know I'm going to be fired. How am I going to take care of my family and live that lifestyle that I was used to do? I had millions of dollars in stock options, but they weren't going to be able to be exercised because I was going to get fired before the exercise date.
Right.
So ADM owed me millions, but I was going to get fired before that date that they could be exercised because that's how stock options work. And so what I did is, knowing they owe me that on that stock options, I wrote a check to myself that equated about $9 million. And I thought, well, that'd give me, based on the composition, basically on the compensation that I was already earning, that'd give me a few years to get back on my feet and try to get a similar job, but I'd have a few years to do it, almost like my own severance package.
Right.
I knew the ADM couldn't turn me in. They're involved with $1 billion theft a year for 12 years in a row. So they're the last guys that could turn me in on a $9 million crime because they're taking billions on the same kind of fraud. So I wrote these checks to myself. I was very safe. I was the safest guy in America. There's no way they could turn me in. There's only three executives above me, and they're involved with a bigger crime. But the day they learned I was an informant, it changed things. Then they could turn me in because I was no longer with them. So basically, they were so mad that about me being the whistleblower on the price fixing, they turned me in on the $9 million fraud, and that's what I went to prison for. I had full immunity on the case prior to that.
Right, but now the FBI is going to give you a team of lawyers to fight you on this. You've got a really great deal. You had what you call the deal of a lifetime and chose not to take it. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah, deal of a lifetime. I mean, it was going to be 6 months in a federal camp. I mean, it's a Martha Stewart sentence.
Right.
6 months in a camp with no fence, a white-collar minimum security camp. And I tell you, I was so mad at that time. I couldn't imagine going to prison for 6 months after I risked my life for the FBI. And then Ginger wanted me to sign the plea agreement, and I was so mad at her that she turned me in the first place. I took that plea agreement and threw it in a trash can and basically fought the case for 3 years with a whole group of different lawyers. I fired the lawyer that recommended the plea agreement.
Right.
And I fought the case for 3 years to get a 10.5-year sentence instead. 3 years later, and I would have had 6 months.
That's crazy. That's crazy. This sent you down a road of just, I would say, delusion, depression. You tried taking your own life before you had the federal prison. That's got to be a moment where things were at the worst of the worst.
Oh, I was at the end of myself. I tried to take my life twice after that point before I was going to go to prison for 8.5 years. There's no parole in the federal system. You get 15% off for good behavior,
yeah,
but no parole's on any federal inmate. So it's not just me without parole. No federal inmate gets parole. That was taken out in the 80s, parole was. So I would have had to do 8.5 years on a 10.5-year sentence, and I just couldn't put my head around that.
Right.
And I tried to take my own life twice, and it's amazing what happened. I thought it was the end of my life, and it's amazing what happened after that.
You talk about a time where somebody showed up at your doorstep, Ian Howes. How crazy is that moment? Tell that story.
Yeah, Ian Howes was a CFO of a large pharmaceutical company, and he was a member of a group called CBMC, Christian Businessmen Connection, which I'd never heard of at that point. This would have been 1997, in September of 97, 21 years ago. And he showed up at my house, and he was reading about me in the newspaper, including the six-month plea agreement and thrown in the trash can, the suicide attempts, and he was reading all this. And God put it on his heart, being a Christian businessman, to reach out to me. I mean, I would have been in the news like Paul Manafort today.
Right.
You know, that type of story. You know, front page news all the time. And he showed up at my doorstep, and he said, you know what, Mark? He said, and this was a month after I attempted suicide. And he said, prison is going to be the beginning of your life, and you're going to find your true purpose in your life of the journey you're ready to start. And I thought that was the craziest thing I ever heard when I'm 7 months from heading to federal prison for a decade.
Right.
And it was amazing how true that was, but it was hard for me to understand that at that point.
What did he tell you?
Well, he said he wanted to take me to a study called Operation Timothy, which was an introduction to the Bible and an introduction to Jesus. And I told him at that point, I said, listen, Ian, my parents forced me to go to church, and I've been going to church with my wife and my kids, so I'm already a Christian. I go to church.
Mm.
He said, Mark, I'm not talking about going to church. I'm talking about introducing you to Jesus, a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And he usually spend about an hour a week with somebody, what he calls a Timothy. He's the Paul, kind of like Paul and Timothy in Scripture. He's the Paul and I was the Timothy. He normally spends about an hour a week for a couple of years. But with me leaving in 7 months, he spent 6, 7, 8 hours a week with me for those 7 months going through Operation Timothy. And basically Bible study introduced me to God and introduced me to Jesus.
And now you go into federal prison. He's still mentoring, discipling you at that point. You finally become a believer a couple of months into federal prison. Talk about that moment.
Yeah, I go to federal prison. I wasn't a Christian yet, but he was definitely giving me some hope. My science background really got in my way at that time. You know, a PhD in biochemistry from Cornell, an Ivy League school, and all you learn in 8 years of college with a bachelor's and master's from Ohio State and a PhD from Cornell is Darwinism and evolution and really everything about there is no God, you know, being a scientist. So that's my education was in my way. It was really a hurdle for me at that point. And then early in my prison sentence, my couple weeks into prison sentence in March of 98, I'm about 7 months with Ian Howe, starting to get some hope, still trying to reconcile my science background. How could God really exist? And Chuck Colson showed up my second week in prison. I didn't even know who he was. He was the White House counsel under President Nixon, had an office right next to the Oval Office when he was in his 30s. He went to prison in the 1970s, about 20 years before me. For the Watergate scandal during the President Nixon scandal for Watergate. And so he read about me in the newspaper, too, like Ian Howes. And he reached out, and he started discipling me along with Ian Howes. And he could get into the prison system a little bit easier because he was the head of prison fellowship, chairman of prison fellowship and CEO. So he had a lot of experience getting in and out of the prison system and visiting rooms and so on. And he started discipling me, Jared, And I tell you, he started sending me things from scientists that believed in God, because I thought no scientist believed in God, no PhD scientist. He started sending me things. And I tell you, I saw even where Albert Einstein said the Big Bang Theory was impossible and only God could create man and the universe. And when I read dozens of articles like that in books that he was sending me, that really showed me that God does exist. I've seen the evidence, the scientific evidence. That God does exist. In my third month in prison in June of 98, 3 months after Chuck Colson, 10 months after being with Ian Howes, I got down on my knees and surrendered my life to Jesus.
That's incredible. Mark, we got about 2 minutes left. Talk about your renewed purpose and what is your purpose for your life?
Oh, I tell you, I started discipling guys in prison. I took 61 guys one by one, one-on-one discipleship through Operation Timothy in prison, introduced them to Jesus. Most productive years of my life at $20 a month for 8 years after $3 million a year for 8 years. And it was the most productive years of my life were in prison. And I've been out now for 12 years, almost 13 years, and I'm still discipling guys. I got 4 Timothys now. And I also go out and speak at prayer breakfasts and outreach luncheons, 7 or 8 a month as a witness, almost 100 events a year as a witness for Jesus that God does indeed exist.
That's awesome. Give us one little takeaway. What is something that I can do and we as listeners can start doing to have more impact and almost living more purposeful in our lives?
Yeah, the impact is there's no better place for ministry than the marketplace. No better place. Ian Howes was CFO of a pharmaceutical company. He reached out to me. You're going to meet a lot of lost and a lot of unconvinced in the marketplace, and that's why God puts us in the marketplace. And there's no better place, I believe, to reach the lost and the unconvinced than the marketplace. No better place for ministry. And Jesus showed us how in Scripture, because most of his public appearances were in the marketplace.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great word. I appreciate that. Your story is amazing. Where can people find more about you and your story?
A lot about my story, including giving my testimony at prayer breakfasts and large events, is on my website, markwhitaker.com. And that's W-H-I-T-A-C-R-E for Mark Whitaker, Mark with a K, and then W-H-I-T-A-C-R-E. .com, and it's got lots of information, documentaries and things of that sort, testimonies on my website.
That is awesome. Mark, God bless you. What an incredible story. I'm so glad that you went to prison for 10 years because this is the man that made. Isn't that crazy?
Miracle of God. I tell you, if I had that 6-month sentence, as my wife said, I would have never listened to Ian Howes and Chuck Colson. I don't believe I'd be a Christian today with that 6-month sentence. So thank God that God brought me to the end of myself.
Amen. Well, I hope hope you enjoyed my conversation with Mark Whitaker. I'm still just blown away by his story and his testimony. An amazing guy. Here's a guy that had money and power, and that journey of life sent him down a road to two attempted suicides, depression, and nearly a decade in federal prison, and that's where God showed up. 3 months into his sentence, he found his real purpose in life, and he considers those 9 years after that in federal prison the most productive years of his life because he was pouring out his life now into other people. A true repurpose story. Amazing. That'll do it for this week's episode of Repurpose. Just a reminder, this show is based on a book by Ben Tages called Repurpose, The Untold Story of Retirement in America. If you want the first two chapters of that book totally free, just go to our website, tagesfinancial.com, and click on Heard Us on the Radio for your free gift just for listening here today. And also a big thanks to Faith Radio for helping sponsor this program. If you missed any or all of this episode, visit myfaithradio.com to hear or download the podcast there. I'm Jared Sebesta. We'll see you next time on Repurposed. Thanks so much for checking out this episode of Repurposed. Just a reminder, these podcasts are only available because of generous support of people just like you. If you'd like to make a gift and support Faith Radio, go to the website, myfaithradio.com. Also, another way you can help is by sharing these podcasts on social media and subscribing. Just click subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast player, and you'll be sure to never miss a show.